Good morning, all. Judge Keeney and I are pleased and privileged to have sitting with us today by designation Judge Chang of the Northern District of Illinois. We look forward to his help. The first case for argument this morning is Gibson versus American Sinomed. Mr. Earle.
May it please the Court. Good morning. I will very briefly address two issues supplemental to the submission regarding subject matter jurisdiction, and then be followed by my co-counsel on the merits. And in light of the expanded record regarding subject matter jurisdiction in this case, I'd like to draw the Court's attention to two key facts, which I think merit dismissal of this appeal, remand of the case back to the district court for remanding back to the state court and vacating all the decisions made below. Those two facts are, first, that in the Glenn Burton versus American Sinomed case, on a case before Judge Adelman in the same district, on July 5th of 2007, Judge Adelman required Millennium Holdings LLC to clarify its status as a limited liability corporation and ask for the identification of the members. That occurred 3 months before this case was removed to the federal court by the defendants, by the Atlantic Richfield Company. That's fact number one. And fact number two is that it is our view that affidavits showing citizenship, once citizenship has been challenged in a situation like this, requires that the affidavit be made on personal knowledge. In this case, the declaration of Regina Lee is not clearly made on personal knowledge. The language of the declaration is, I am familiar with the books and records of Millennium Holdings LLC and the other companies referred to below. I make this declaration based on my review of those corporate books and records or the review undertaken by others under my direction. So we are unable to determine which aspects of that declaration are based on the personal knowledge of Regina Lee as opposed to the personal knowledge of others who took the review under her direction.
She ever deposed?
No, Your Honor. No, she was never deposed. So these two facts, I think, make this case similar to
Burton.
What?
Similar to Burton?
No. I think it's this case is similar to Thomas v. Guardsmark and Tickler versus Gerber.
Could you just tell me the status of Burton?
The Burton case has stayed pending the outcome of this appeal. And as we know, based on the supplemented record from the defendant appellees, the citizenship of the members of Millennium Holdings LLC were mistaken. The information was mistakenly provided to Judge Adelman. It was, in fact, mistaken. And lastly, I would just simply draw the Court's attention to the fact that we have not invoked federal jurisdiction. The plaintiff has not invoked federal jurisdiction in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Earle. Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm going to address the issues raised concerning substantive due process and the constitutional challenge to the Thomas decision. And I think that the issues here boil down to two salient issues. And the first is whether the Thomas decision even raises a substantive due process that can be reviewed by this Court, and if it does, what standards should be applied to review the Thomas decision. The Thomas decision here did two things. The underlying court, one, found that the state court, Article 1, Section 9 of the state court constitution, mandated that children who are injured by lead paint have a remedy for their injury. And then second, consistent with that mandate and to implement that mandate, it defined the manner in which causation could and should be proven in those particular circumstance and class of cases. And it did so very specifically in the context of both negligence and strict liability cases and made very clear that the basic law that was to be applied in each of those cases was both negligence and strict liability. It is the appellant's position that this type of state court decision is not subject to federal constitutional review, that it's offensive to comity to suggest that a federal court should review a state court's interpretation of its own constitution and its own determination of what the state constitution requires in a particular circumstance. And that is particularly true in circumstances such as this, where that constitutional mandate and what the court did does not in any way impact a federal constitutional right. There is no substantive federal constitutional right that is implicated by the Thomas decision at all. And instead, what appellee's claim is implicated is a state-created property right in their money. They claim that the fact that they may, at the end of a tort claim, be subject to a damages award by a jury is a state-protected property right. And then they next claim, perhaps recognizing that that alone, again, does not raise federal constitutional review, that there's no adequate state remedy available to them. That point we highly contest. Here there is a very adequate state remedy that is available to the appellees here. The Thomas Court spent a significant amount of time going through exactly the proof, the burdens of proof, what had to be proven, but it also made clear that each of these defendants at the close of the case could apply to the court on public policy grounds for a reduction and a review of whatever damages award might be awarded against them. And that's particularly relevant here, where the court would look at the potential conduct of each of the defendants, lead pigment defendants, and be able to see whether the damages award, imposition of joint and several liability, principles of comparative and contributory negligence, applied to reduce what that particular award is. So the state court built in a process for addressing the very types of concerns.
Ms. Fitzpatrick, that it was the direction was specific enough. If you were a trial judge in Wisconsin after reading Thomas, as to understand the remedy, but that's suggested by the high court in Wisconsin, but what the direction is to the circuit. What kind of hearing do you envision would be held in the state court?
In a post-liability determination, when damages have been found, it is my understanding or my interpretation that each of the defendant lead pigment manufacturers could apply to the court on both a factual record and introduce facts that they wanted to introduce, as well as a legal record. And that's particularly important for this reason. Each of the defendants is concerned that they are going to have to pay some share of liability that exceeds that which they could possibly be responsible for. And the Thomas Court specifically found that the Wisconsin state principles governing comparative and contributory negligence are available to each of these defendants to reduce the amount that they would have to pay under a particular circumstance. So each of these defendants has the full ability to come in with the evidence that they have and say that of all of the lead that was manufactured, we were only responsible for 4% or 8% or 12%. They have the ability to come in and...
You're suggesting it would be based on market share? Is that what the trial court would look to?
I don't think that it's a single issue that the trial court would look to. I think that the trial court made clear, or the Supreme Court made clear, that there are a multitude of factors that the trial court could look to. And the reason that I'm focusing on that particular issue is the Gibson court here made some determinations concerning the severity of the liability and being disproportionate to the responsibility for that liability. And that particular issue, which I don't believe can be assessed in a constitutional or should be assessed in a constitutional issue, is specifically something that the Thomas Court saw should be addressed after the trial and is one of the factors that the court can look at for public policy. And I think that there are a host of public policy considerations that each of these defendants can raise specifically to the trial court upon a finding of damages against them.
What would you describe as a public policy issue that could be raised?
Well, I think that there's the public policy issues are, as I mentioned, the extent of liability, the extent of responsibility for the risk of harm, because Thomas looks to the record to say that the plaintiff has carried its burden of proving that each of these defendants contributed to the risk of harm to the public. And upon assessment of that risk form, each of these defendants has the ability to come back and challenge the extent to which they were involved, the extent to their involvement here, the extent of the damages, the extent to which the damages are disproportionate to their own personal experience, the extent to which the damages are not supported by the injuries or what was proven in the case by the particular plaintiff. So all of those traditional public policy considerations that are available under Wisconsin law were specifically incorporated by the Thomas decision by the Thomas Court into its decision and are available for each of these defendants at the time that they would have a potential liability in the particular case.
May I ask, then you don't envision that those types of arguments can be made to the jury by the defendants if they are trying to allocate comparative negligence?
I think that those can be made to the jury, and in fact, what's interesting is that we are here on the to review the Thomas decision. The Thomas decision later went to trial, and Mr. Earle and I tried that case. Those very arguments certainly were raised by the defendants, both in motions for summary judgment, and one particular defendant was able to exculpate themselves from liability because they were able to prove in summary judgment that they did not manufacture white lead carbonate in the particular jurisdiction. Each of the defendants raised a defense, a factual defense, attempting to convince the jury that they could not have been responsible for the particular white lead carbonate that was present in Mr. Thomas's home and poisoned him. And each of them raised those issues before the jury. That is the first level of review that they have, and that's something that the jury can consider when reaching its decision on whether there is liability here and what that liability should be. And then what the Thomas Court did is it found further that those other issues, those public policy issues, could also be considered by the court in a determination as to whether the damages awarded in a particular case were in keeping with the evidence and the facts in that particular record.
Then that the public policy review post-verdict sounds like nothing more than a new trial motion.
Well, there would be some overlap in those, but there's also the ability, and it's what I think is specific here and is different than other cases, is the Thomas Court, in deciding these issues, specifically reserved to the trial court the ability to look at these public policy issues. And it's these public policy issues that give, and the ability of a state court to review those public policy issues, that give these defendants an adequate remedy at state law. That coupled with their traditional remedies that are available to all parties in new trial motions, motions for reduced verdict, all of those are available. So this is not a circumstance in which the defendants, to the extent that they even have a property right that's implicated here, have no ability to challenge or to avail themselves of the judicial process to review the damages award or that takings. They have a full panoply available to them under the state law, which provides them the remedies that are necessary and the remedies that are adequate under state law. And it's the fact that that state law affords those remedies and affords them the ability to do that that takes this case outside of the purview of a substantive federal due process review.
Mr. Spadri, if you recall, what type of instructions on public policy were given in the Thomas case as far as the consideration by the jury, if you recall?
Your Honor, honestly, I do not specifically recall what that was. But the public policy provisions are also what goes to the trial court post-trial. If, however, this court were to reach the merits and consider whether this complies with substantive due process, I think that the major issue there is what's the test that this court is going to apply to review that decision. Is it going to adhere to the very traditional rational basis test that has been articulated for decades and in dozens, if not hundreds, of cases? Or is it going to embark on a new constitutional test that was articulated by the Gibson Court based on a takings clause analysis by a plurality in Eastern Enterprises? And at this point, there is no reason to at all, and no rationale and no legal basis to diverge from the traditional rational basis test. Now, the rational basis test doesn't ask whether a reviewing court, whether the Gibson court, agrees with the decision of the Thomas court or would have reached that same conclusion had it been sitting on the Wisconsin Supreme Court back in 2005. But instead, what it asks is either one of two things. If it is a rebuttable presumption that was created by the Thomas court, then the question is whether there's a rational relationship between the fact presumed and the facts that were proven in the record, and whether the defendants have the ability to challenge that rebut that presumption. Or if it does create new liability, which is what the appellees claim, is there a rational basis and is there a legitimate state interest that was advanced by the Thomas Court in reaching that decision? As to the rebuttable presumption, the Burton Court looked at this, and I think that the facts of the Thomas Court make clear that there is a very rational connection between the assumption that the defendants, or the presumption, I should say, that the defendants are responsible for the white lead carbonate that injured a particular child based on the factual record of the lengthy history of these companies in manufacturing, promoting, and selling white lead carbonate for use in paint. In addition, the Thomas Court sets forth at least two elements that each of these defendants can invoke to rebut the presumption. First, that they didn't manufacture at the appropriate time, or they didn't manufacture in the appropriate location or appropriate geographical area. That satisfies the rational basis test for a rebuttable presumption, and the rebuttable presumption passes constitutional muster.
So other than establishing that you were not in the market, is there anything else that one of the companies could have put forward to impact either liability or damage?
Sure, they can put in any facts that they want.
I'm kind of asking what you might offer up as the kind of facts they could present.
Well, I think that, first, the dates of the manufacturing history. I think, second, the types of lead carbonate that were promoted. I think that factually, when you're looking at these cases and you have a paint chip that might be 50 layers deep and has 16 or 18 layers of white lead carbonate, there were defenses that were raised in the Thomas case about dating of the paint chip layers to exculpate someone's particular place in the market. There's evidence that can be presented about the amount or the extent of involvement in the market at a particular time to say, you know, it is unlikely that it is our white lead carbonate that was what poisoned the particular child. There can be evidence that, and this happened in the case of ConAgra Grocery Products that was dismissed from the case, that they didn't sell in the particular jurisdiction. They did not have a retail presence or marketing presence in Wisconsin, so therefore it could not have been their white lead carbonate. There were chemists that were presented at trial by each of the defendants, which challenged the paint layers and what was in the paint layers. There's a whole host of factual evidence that can be put forth at trial to convince the jury, if the facts support it, that a particular defendant could not have been responsible for the poisoning of a particular child. The question here for these particular defendants is it's very difficult for these particular defendants to do that, given their personal history and the facts surrounding their manufacture and sale of white lead carbonate. But you cannot say the facts as they apply to me are so onerous and so bad that you cannot impose a remedy. It's not that someone cannot rebut it. It's that under a particular factual circumstance, a particular defendant may not be able to rebut it because of facts specific to it.
If we were to accept your position and reverse on the question of substantive due process, could you speak for a moment to the procedural due process question that's raised by Sherwin-Williams?
Your Honor, I don't believe that there is any procedural due process issue that has been appropriately or properly raised here. Every defendant that has been before this court or before the court down below has had 12 to 13 years of the ability to avail themselves of every procedure that is available under the rules to protect themselves from liability. There is nothing at all that implicates any procedural due process here. as well as, and I will also mention this, there is nothing that implements or implicates the takings clause of the Constitution, which I know was an issue that was raised by some of the defendants as well and was raised by the court below on its reconsideration. It's just on its face there is no takings, and I don't believe there's any law that would support the idea that the potential award of damages in a tort case can possibly be a taking without just compensation by a state actor. So I think that those two analyses don't apply at all.
May I ask, before your time is up, with regard to fungibility, the Thomas Court viewed the question of fungibility in the light most favorable to Thomas as the plaintiff, and the case was on summary judgment. As it played out at trial, in the state trial, did the plaintiff first have to prove that the pigment was fungible, and then the jury was instructed on risk contribution, or was risk contribution, was that instruction going to be given in light of the Thomas decision?
I do not recall whether there was a specific fungibility instruction that was given at the time. There was evidence that was introduced through our experts and our chemists concerning all of the facts, including those of fungibility, what white lead carbonate was, the fact that it was functionally interchangeable with each other, what NL made could be used where DuPont's was made, could be used where ARCO's was made. And there was also evidence that was introduced of the interrelationship between these particular manufacturers, that one particular pigment manufacturer would sell its pigment for use in another pigment manufacturer's ultimate lead paint. And so those were all issues that went to the jury and could be concerned. In the Thomas case specifically, the jury did not reach those issues solely because it found that the child's lead poisoning was not the cause of that particular child's injuries.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Curtis?
Good morning. May it please the Court, based solely on decades-old manufacture of white lead, the ad hoc retroactive Thomas rule subjects my client individually and each of the other companies individually to potentially hundreds of millions of dollars in judgment debt without any nexus, causal or otherwise, to any plaintiff. This is the rare case in which a retroactive rule is so extreme and severe and so singling out in its adoption that constitutional limits have been surpassed. Indeed, this rule, as far as we can tell, is singular in its occurrence. The rule has not been adopted by any other state for this or any other product. The rule adopted for white lead pigment is even more extreme than the rule that the Wisconsin court adopted for DES some years ago in a number of key respects. And so far as we know, there's no other jurisdiction where any other rule even comparably approaching this is active today. Market share for DES in a handful of jurisdictions was an idea whose time came and went. What Wisconsin did here is to make a special rule applicable to and only to these six companies. What they did here was make a rule to apply to conduct that ceased many decades ago, in some instances potentially as long as a century ago. And they did it with the express intent and effect to reach back over the decades to make it possible for liability to be imposed based on that long closed conduct. The very point of the rule is to make it possible for a large group of plaintiffs who admittedly can show no connection whatsoever to any of these defendants, the ability to recover against them. And that type of retroactive change in the law offends substantive due process because it is arbitrary. And it also, in the view of a number of the members of the Supreme Court, would offend the takings clause. And based solely on the specific content of this retroactive rule, its complete elimination of any need to show causation at all, period. There's no presumption, there's no burden shifting here, there is an elimination of any causation requirement at all, standing alone.
Well, the plaintiff does have to show that leg pigment caused the injury that the plaintiff has.
They do have to show that white lead caused, was ingested by the plaintiff and caused the injury, and that's it. And they have to show, of course, that a company, and there's a tendency on the plaintiff's part to talk about these companies in the collective, but there's no collective theory other than this one that brings them together. The plaintiffs should have to show a causal connection to each one of them, and there's no other causal burden other than to show ingestion of white lead and injury from that ingestion. Now, this rule, as I said, offends the Constitution and substantive due process because it is arbitrary. Justice Breyer's dissenting opinion for the four dissenters in the Eastern Enterprises case is quite instructive as a matter of substantive due process analysis. And Justice Breyer, as you recall, said, and I think correctly said, a law that is fundamentally unfair because of its retroactivity is basically arbitrary. And that's what we have here. The dissenters in Eastern Enterprise, like Justice Kennedy in his concurring opinion, and like the plurality, all recognized that when a retroactive change in law is specially designed to single out a limited class, there's a problem. Justice Breyer reasoned that the Due Process Clause, quote, protects against this kind of fundamental unfairness. It protects against an unfair allocation of public burdens through this kind of specially arbitrary retroactive means. And you'll recall that the front part of the Thomas opinion is the recitation of an existing social problem about which there may be dispute about some of the details, but it's acknowledged that there is a social problem. Justice Breyer's language fits that to a T. And Justice Kennedy, in his concurring opinion, pointed out that the particular evil of retroactive rulemaking such as this, as a matter of substantive due process, is that it provides a means of after-the-fact retribution against unpopular groups or individuals. Now, as we showed in our brief, the five-factor test that the plurality developed in Eastern Enterprises and applied under the Takings Clause is a five-factor test that the other opinions subscribed to in substance. They adverted to it, and they subscribed to it, and I submit that that's a very good test of when a retroactive rule is so arbitrary that it offends substantive due process as well as the Takings Clause.
Mr. Curtis, we don't find that, though, in Justice Kennedy's concurrence, do we?
We find his acknowledgement that the underlying reasoning of the plurality opinion is sound. I mean, he doesn't say the five factors and list them, but he endorses the analysis they apply. He would doctrinally put it elsewhere in the Constitution, as would the dissenters. And there's no doubt, as the Eastern Enterprises and the Stop the Beach opinion show, that there is an interesting doctrinal debate at play in the Supreme Court on these sorts of issues. But But the underlying test, how do you tell when a retroactive, all of them recognize that retroactive lawmaking can be deeply offensive to our system of law. And the question is, how do you tell? And I think that the five-factor test is a very good test and applies very clearly here. There is severe liability. There is extreme retroactivity, much more than was at issue in Eastern Enterprises, or I think in any other case that I've read in connection with this matter. A limited class of individuals are the victims of this retroactive lawmaking. No question about that here. This is not a general rule of law, McPherson against Buick, changing the law. This is a specially designed rule for these six companies. It is impossible for them to have anticipated the rule. There's no question about that.
How about the possibility of incurring liability for entering the market with a product that has the potential to create a tortious result?
I didn't hear the fun part of your question.
Well, the issue of potential harm has been there, as you noted, for decades. So a decision to enter the market with the product, is there a foreseeability that your product might I'm speaking now to the likelihood that you would be aware that you would be subject to a liability such as the type imposed by Thomas?
Well, I don't think that there was any likelihood that anyone in, let's say, 1910 or 20 or 30 would be liable to the, you know, to everybody in the world.
I'm talking, let's say, the last 25, 30 years. Entering the market.
Well, nobody's entered the market in the last 25 or 30 years.
No, but the products have gone into the market, not entered anew, Mr. Curtis, but I meant continue to supply.
No one has been permitted to sell this product since 1978.
Right.
And as you know from the record, many of these companies stopped selling it long before that.
Right.
And in terms of duty versus consequences, I know the plaintiffs in their briefing make a point that, well, we have to assume there was a breach of a duty long ago, and I'm not arguing that we have to assume that. The breach of a duty in issue in this case, and the only one in issue, is a failure to warn, not that they shouldn't have made the product. But that's not all that's a problem in terms of retroactivity. This Court's own Mojica decision decided en banc, although a statutory interpretation case, was nonetheless, I think, cognizant of constitutional limits, and it's viewed as part of the constitutional canon in this area of the law, I would submit. And it recognized that significant changes in sanctions or consequences was alone enough, and I think this qualifies under that rubric. And that was picked up by the Supreme Court in the Landgraf case, where it also said that significant change in the consequences for long closed conduct, not necessarily just the imposition of a new duty that makes conduct that was once not tortious, but changing the scope of the consequences. Now, the last two factors in the five-part test are disproportionality, or the last one actually is disproportionate, unanticipated, I just mentioned. And the fact is that this liability is, I think, in contradistinction to Collins, designed to be disproportionate. There was a subsequent case that went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, a lead pigment case called Godoy. And the Godoy case appears in the Sherwin-Williams brief. You'll find it there. And in numbered paragraph 23 of that opinion, the Wisconsin Supreme Court expressly states that its Thomas rule is a rule that imposes joint and several liability. There's nothing about comparative fault there. There's something about comparative fault in the Collins opinion, but not in the Thomas opinion. And the court said it's a joint and several liability question as between the plaintiff and each of these defendants. You can get a judgment against that defendant that makes that defendant a joint and several debtor for the entire amount of the judgment, leaving open what might someday exist inter se among the defendants. So that's the rule we're dealing with here. It's a rule that makes no effort to scale the potential scope of liability to anything that any one of these defendants did. Justice Breyer asked another very good, or made another very good statement in his substantive due process analysis. He said, ultimately, the substantive due process question is the fairness question. In that case, why Eastern Enterprises? Here, picking my client as an example, why Atlantic Richfield? Now, the Thomas Court frequently used a phrase, could reasonably have contributed to the risk, which I think when it's parsed down to its nub is it's possible. And the litany of reasonably could have facts with respect to my client or any of the others that they might answer to the fairness question reasonably could have not contributed to the injury of any one of these 170-plus plaintiffs, including Mr. Gibson. Reasonably could have never manufactured any of the pigment that is found on any of their homes. Reasonably could have had any pigment found in the state of Wisconsin that could have been, if we could do it, traced to them on exteriors rather than interiors. There really is no good answer to the fairness question from the plaintiff's perspective here, and that's, in essence, what makes this arbitrary. We all know this is about line drawing. We all know that if the state of Wisconsin decided to line up all the possible payors and pick off every fifth one and say, step forward, you're going to pay because we have to get some money for this problem, we'd all react that that's arbitrary. And the question is where, as we move across the scale towards some connection, some linkage to the particular plaintiff, arbitrariness ends and fairness begins. And I submit here that it's very clear from the Supreme Court's jurisprudence that the mere fortuity of having been in the industry is not enough. In every case where they have analyzed this, in Gray and in Concrete Pipe, the two multi-employer plan cases in which they analyzed this, and in Turner Elkhorn, the black lung case where they analyzed this, and in Eastern Enterprises itself, they always looked for something beyond mere presence as a factor in the industry. In the case of the two multi-employer cases, they looked to the proportionality of the withdrawal penalty imposed in the Gray case in terms of proportionality to the employment relationships that had contributed to the need for insurance. In Concrete Pipe, they looked to the fact that even though the complaining employer may not have had the employees vest in the plan while working for him, the period of time that they worked for Concrete Pipe contributed to the vesting liability. And in Eastern Enterprises itself, Justice Breyer, arguing for a substantive due process test and finding that it would not have been violated there, didn't stop by, with just presence in the industry. He looked to three factors that he found that showed there was enough of a connection to Eastern Enterprises to make it fair to reach back in time and impose liability with a change in the rules. One was an employment relationship. Two was the dissenter's belief that there was a de facto commitment to lifetime benefits. And three was continuing profit from the coal industry after the time when lifetime benefits were promised through a subsidiary. So in every instance, the court has looked for something more than the mere fortuity of being in an industry.
Well, may I ask, the cases you rely on with regard to retroactivity assign substantive liability to the subject of the statutes in those cases. What's your response to the argument that this is really a procedural change and that substantively the plaintiff still has to prove that the defendants breached a duty?
I detect a couple of questions there. First, the plaintiffs say, you know, there's no substantive change in the law here. It's just a burden shift. It's just a presumption. Well, nothing can be further from the truth. Presumably, the Wisconsin Supreme Court knows how to say presumption if it wants to say presumption. and you can search both Collins and Thomas. And through the convenience of modern word processing, the majority opinion in Thomas is the only one of those two opinions that even uses the word presumption, and it's when they decide not to address the constitutional issue presented by the defendants. They are not adopting a presumption, and they're not because they tell us they're not. They tell us in language first used in Collins and then adopted in Thomas, we are confronting a problem here in which the plaintiff cannot recover under existing common law. And we have to either fashion a rule using the Supreme Court's words that deviates from existing law or leave them without a remedy, and we choose the former. The court then begins its analysis of fashioning a rule, and it announces generally in the law of torts, a plaintiff must prove duty, breach, injury, as well as causation, and in the ensuing paragraph, they announce that they are eliminating causation. This is not a case in which the plaintiff is given the benefit of a presumption that the Atlantic Richfield Company's predecessor made the pigment that injured you. If that is not what's happening, or that any other individual defendant's pigment injured you, and you now must step forward and rebut. So there is a dramatic change in the law. And the change in the law is that the causation requirement has been swept away. In terms of...
But hasn't just the burden of proof been shifted to the defendant to prove the negative?
Not at all. Not at all. The only two things that have been given to the defendant as exculpation in the Thomas opinion are that they can prove that they were not selling during the time the house was in existence. And that means any time that the house was in existence. So if the house was built in Gibson's case in 1919 and the selling of white lead ended in 1978, they're left with the opportunity, which of course the court knew when it wrote the sentence, they in most instances could never do. And the second opportunity was to prove not in the geographic market. It's true that ConAgra was allowed out of the Thomas case before it went to trial because they could prove they never marketed white lead pigment east of the Rocky Mountains. Well, that may have been a help to ConAgra, but to a lot of other companies who, you know, manufactured in East Chicago or some other place and had their product go on rail cars going who knows where, 60 or 70 or 80 years after the fact, that is not much of an exculpatory opportunity. The instructions given to the Thomas jury on causation, there was an instruction on causation of brain damage from the ingestion of white lead, and there was an instruction given explicitly that the plaintiff did not need to show which manufacturer made the pigment that caused the harm. Now, is it true that if we are required to try cases under this rule, we will not lay down and we will be as creative as we can be to try and find ways to convince courts that the rule should not apply to us? Of course we will. But the fact is that this rule is the rule that stands in the state of Wisconsin right now, and it subjects our clients to the risk individually of the judgments I mentioned. And the procedure that was mentioned at the opening of the plaintiff's argument for after-the-fact public policy relief is not a special procedure for this rule. It's not written into the Thomas opinion. It's a procedure of Wisconsin law. It's extraordinary, and all it would do is, we'd have trial judges looking over their shoulder at a Supreme Court that wrote the Thomas opinion trying to decide whether they should vitiate the rule or not. Unless the court has questions for me, I have nothing else.
Just one, Mr. Curtis. So that I understand your position, off of your last few remarks, is it your position that absent showing that you were not in the market, though you said if you had to try cases under this rule, you would be creative, is there any other defense other than not being in the market?
The only two that the Thomas rule announces are proving that you didn't make the product during the time the house existed and that you didn't sell in the geography.
So those are the only avenues of defense, right?
I don't want to rule out creativity, but...
No, I didn't mean to suggest that. I'm just trying to focus on what confronts us in this case.
And I think the Godoy statement in paragraph 23 of the Godoy opinion from the court, that its rule is a joint and several liability rule, is what makes it clear that it's a rule even more targeted and extreme than DES, which on its face, in the Collins opinion, there's a whole elaborate discussion of comparative fault and how this will make the rule more closely approximate liability to harm. It's a very different rule. It's also a very different rule because there the plaintiff had the burden of showing that it ingested the same type in terms of identifying characteristics, size, shape, and so on, of DES that was marketed by a particular company. There's nothing like that here.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Curtis. Patrick, I think your time had expired, but we've asked a fair number of questions, so you may have a couple of minutes, and I wonder if you might start by responding to this challenge by Mr. Curtis that subsequent language by the Wisconsin Supreme Court impacts the question of joint and several liability.
Your Honor, what happened there was the Supreme Court there was reiterating the rule, the general rule of joint and several liability in Wisconsin as it applied to this particular case because of the date of the injury. There's a change in 1995 in how joint and several liability was applied in Wisconsin. The Thomas decision and the Godoy decisions were pre-1995 cases, so what this court there was doing was adopting and looking at the rule of joint and several liability at the particular time that existed. But it was not a rule that was specifically concocted from this case. And I think that instead what it indicates is the court here is applying the very traditional elements of negligence and strict liability and the interpretation of negligence and strict liability in the context of these lead poisoning cases. Now, what Mr. Curtis did was he misrepresented or misunderstands what the Thomas Court requires and what the Thomas Court does not require. The Thomas Court is very clear in requiring that there be proof of a tortious act by each of these defendants, that there be proof of injury, that there be proof of damages, and it is very clear, despite what Mr. Curtis says, that every plaintiff is required to prove causation in a risk contribution case.
But and causation in the sense that the injury was caused by the ingestion of the paint, right?
Correct. You have to prove in each of these that the paint was ingested, that the ingestion caused injury, that each of these manufacturers manufactured and during the relevant time period, and that their conduct at the time that they manufactured and sold was tortious, that it breached a duty to this particular plaintiff. Now, you've asked some questions on the ability to exculpate, and I give you an example of, for example, a 1950 home. If we have a child who was poisoned in a home that was built in 1950, there are a number of defenses that are available to a particular defendant. For example, some of these defendants only sold white lead carbonate up through 1924 and could not be responsible for the poisoning of that particular child. Others sold leaded pigments, but in significantly lesser quantities post-1950 and could introduce that evidence that they could not be responsible for that particular child. Some may not have manufactured in 1950 or beyond in Wisconsin and therefore could not be responsible for that particular child. And so that's what the importance of risk contribution and this blanket prohibition against risk contribution is extremely difficult because each case presents a very different scenario. Another analogy that I can give on the causation front is it's like six factories lining a stream, each of which are dumping toxic chemicals into the stream, which flow downstream. And 2 miles away, little Johnny takes a glass of water from that stream every day and he drinks it. And we know that each of them put the exact same toxic chemical into that water. And we know that each of them did it tortiously. And we know that that's the chemical that poisoned little Johnny downstream from taking his glass of water every day and drinking it. And it's in that circumstance saying that little Johnny doesn't have to prove that his particular glass of water had a molecule from each of the particular plant. It is a reasonable presumption based on those facts to say that each of the six factories was responsible for poisoning that stream, and therefore each of those was responsible for the poison that was ingested by the child 2 miles downstream as he drank from it every day. That's what the Thomas decision does. It doesn't do more than that. Mr. Curtis offers no explanation for why this court should diverge from the rational basis test. And while he urges you adopt this Eastern Enterprises case, he offers no explanation. And the reason that he doesn't is because it's an admission that it can't succeed under that particular test. And then the final issue that I wanted to raise is this issue of retroactivity. Common law is retroactive. Per se, it has to be retroactive. That is the way that common law develops. And that is the danger of taking a precedent that was developed for a legislative scheme where there's a choice of the legislature to say it is prospective or retroactive only and attempting to wholesale import it into a common law decision. It's irrelevant even if it is retroactive because that's something that's universal in every common law case. But I think it's particularly important here where it is not imposing retroactive liability because the tortious conduct was tortious at that time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.